1 Corinthians, Paul says, "For we are God's fellow workers. You are God's field. You are God's building. According to the grace of God which was given to me, as a wise master builder, I have laid the foundation, and another builds upon it. But let each one take heed how he builds on it, for no other foundation can anyone lay than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ." In this podcast, we explore those who went the wrong way. We examine how it happened, why it happened, and who it happened to. But most importantly, we always ask the question, could it happen to us? Thanks for joining us here on Faith, Frauds, and Falsehoods. Before we begin, we want to be clear, the opinions that we present are ours alone and do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of our respective churches or employers. Now, let's begin.
Okay, we are now live. We have comments and polls on the Facebook interface.
Oh, cool.
I don't believe the Riverside interface is the same chat as Facebook. Yep. But we do have the Facebook interface. And we'll go from there.
Get up back on Facebook.
You might have to reopen your Facebook account.
Not looking forward to that. I guess if it's only for this, it won't be so bad.
Well, while we're getting things set up, let me send you a message with a link that may work without you having a Facebook.
Oh, that would be nice.
Let's see here. Is this supposed to give you producer access? But I will tell you.
Surely that means that you got to log in, right?
We'll find out. There's your link.
Sweet. Yep. You must log in to continue.
Okay. Well, we can deal with that later. Log in. Okay, y'all. Well, let me get us started then. So, welcome, friends and other folks. This is our first video recorded of our podcast, Faith, Frauds, and Falsehoods. Tonight, we're going to cover the Manson family. The Manson family was headed by Charles Manson. Many, many people have heard of him. This story's been told many times. But we're going to go over it because we realize it's a very famous cult that we've not yet covered. He has some very interesting things in the cult here that I think is important. Yeah, there's the whole typical, you know, I'm in control of everything and I'm going to make my leaders do what. There's a lot of sex involved. That's a normal thing for cult leaders, you know.
Yep.
But there's also some very interesting cultural influences that have to do with the times and things. So I'm excited to get into that. And his theology is not terribly unique.
It's out there. He's got some things that, as I dug in more and more, I was like, this fits a lot more than I expected.
Oh yeah, he's definitely wacko, but one thing you'll hear us talk about is the insane game. He's trying to play the insane game, and I think some of that folds into that. So let's do some Sound of Music here, and let's start at the very beginning.
Awesome.
Where are we considering the very beginning on this? Are we going to go all the way back to his childhood? That's kind of where I was thinking about.
You know, we did that for Jim Jones, right? You know, we talked about Jim Jones back in May of last year, right? One of the things that we did was we had to go back to his early childhood and some of the things that he had experienced. Mostly because in his case, it mattered, right? There were...
in his case, it was very pivotal on what it did with the rest of it.
Okay.
What was you thinking was the thing with his case? You kind of... Unfortunately, you kind of froze up there, Brian. I don't know what happened.
It just said my internet went out for a second.
it's going to be one of those things. It's like Lord of Spirits and Father Stephen. With Jim Jones, a lot of the history, right, of his childhood was vital, right? It was important because you could see as he was growing up, he started to exhibit some of the things that turned him into a cult leader, right? As a child, he did these things.
Well, and that's exactly the case with Charles Manson as well. You know, he started out in life not very great. His mother was a criminal. There's stories that possibly she was a prostitute. She definitely ran some scams on people. His mother was definitely a rebel compared to her upbringing. Her father had passed away, and her mother, Charles Manson's grandmother, was very religious, a Nazarene. But his mother was not. She never joined the Nazarene church, and she actually ended up going to prison when Charles was a little boy. Her and his uncle went to prison, and nobody knew what to do with little Charles. So his aunt and her husband and his cousin took him in, and you know, there's lots of stories about that. About, well, they took him in and they took care of him, or some say they didn't really take care of him. He was very independent and very alone for a long time.
Right.
You know, the way a child is raised is very important, and he didn't get a good proper raising.
Right.
He was known to be antisocial and known to be picked on. He was always a small boy. And so he got picked on a lot. And later on, his mom eventually got out of prison and he got to move back with his mom. But that didn't last very long either. She found her a boyfriend who didn't like him. So she ended up taking him off and sending him to reform school, basically. Do they still have those things around?
Again, yes and no. I mean, obviously you can find anything anywhere in the world, right? It's hard to say that one thing completely no longer exists, but probably not in the same vein that they used to.
Yeah, so what these schools were was they would be schools often for young boys where they would basically implement lots and lots of discipline. Some schools were downright abusive.
Right.
This is where I should add a disclaimer here that this is probably going to get marked explicit on Apple. We will try to talk about things with a very... I can't think of the word, but we'll try to talk about things carefully. But it's impossible to tell the story of Charles Manson without telling about the abuse of Charles Manson.
Right.
And...
just like Jones and Tony Alamo. I mean, it's a lot of these guys, you just can't avoid the situation, right? Because it was such a core thing that was part of it.
Hurt people hurt people.
Yep.
And he was hurt on a massive scale. So he went to this reform school, and one of the first things that happened to him is that he was raped in this all-boys school. He was a small boy, and he was extremely picked on and abused. The staff basically put up with it. That's just how things were.
Right.
He tried to find ways to survive, and he learned to manipulate people by using what he called the insane game, where he would just act crazy. If he act crazy enough, people would leave him alone. He could often get out of trouble if he just acted crazy enough. And, you know, I don't identify with Charles Manson too much here, but I actually kind of identify with this a little bit because as a kid growing up, I moved a lot. You know, I went to over 30 different schools as a kid. Indian was only four high schools, and it was very difficult a lot of times when you move to a new school to make friends and stuff. And a lot of times kids would want to fight and stuff like that. And I learned that the best way to avoid fights was the first time some kid wanted to fight, you did it. You just jumped up and you fought. You just jumped and acted crazy. No holds barred, hitting. It don't matter winning, losing. You just keep going until they physically make you stop.
Right.
Well, when you act like a fool, people don't want to deal with you. And then that makes you have no friends anyway, you know?
I was going to say, but at the same time, then you wind up losing out on the chance to make some friends.
Right. So I sort of identify, not to the same level that Charles Manson had, obviously, here. But so he used this insane game thing.
I don't know.
to get through. Yeah. And as he got in trouble for stuff, he would get out. He'd be home for a little bit. He tried to live with his grandmother for a little bit, went to church with her because it was required in her house. He tried to live with his uncle and aunt again. He went to go visit them one Christmas, as the story's told, and he stayed home from church and stole his uncle's gun. Not necessarily to shoot anybody, but he just liked the gun.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And so he was in trouble, and then he would get sent to one school, and then he'd get in trouble there. And then he was also very charming. Many times he was considered for early release. Sometimes he got early release and he would get out and then he'd do something else and he'd go back in. Very often when he'd get in trouble with the law, the judges were lenient to him and they sent him to reform school. They'd send him to different places. He was in Boys Club, or Boys Town, famously. That didn't work so well. He was sentenced to several different places in a couple different areas of the country. Ended up spending most of his childhood from, I don't know what it was, 9 or 10 years old until he was 17 in these different boys' schools, reform schools, things, where he was often court-mandated to be in them. The first time, his mom dropped him off. But after that, he was mandated to be in them. Many times, he would be almost ready to get out, and then he'd do some offense. When he was a teenager, he was almost ready to get out, and then he was caught raping a child. And because he was a child, they don't prosecute him as a child. They don't prosecute him as an adult. So he was never like a sex offender and all that. They didn't have all that then. And so he was fixing to get out like days before, and they caught him doing that. So then he was in for a couple more years. But eventually, I'm trying to keep this under our time limit for our things here. There's so much of the story.
Yeah, there is. There's a lot.
Eventually, he gets out. He meets a lady, young woman, and they get married. But this time, his mama has moved to L.A. And, I'm leaving out an important part. While he was in those schools, he did pick up a job skill of learning how to do some mechanical work, helping fix cars and trucks and stuff. So that was something he picked up. He also learned how to steal vehicles. So when he got out, he was doing some stealing of vehicles.
Yep.
Now, he knew better than to steal vehicles where he was at, because the local mob boss guy there would get mad. So he'd go across state lines and steal vehicles.
Right.
And bring them back and try to sell them. So anyways, so he tried to, you know, go straight. He tried to work a regular job, but they never paid enough money. He wasn't real good at it. He got fired from a lot of things. He had worked on a horse farm for a while, shoveling, not a horse farm, a horse track, shoving out stalls, brushing out horses. So he knew something about taking care of horses. So he moved out to LA with his new wife. They stole a car. He stole a car. His wife didn't know. They drove out to L.A. to go move out there by his mama. He loved L.A. You know, from living in the Midwest previously and then moving out to L.A., that was a big deal. The problem is he was driving the stolen car around for just weeks and weeks. And eventually they ran the car and figured out it was stolen.
Eventually it catches up, right.
Yeah, this was the 50s. 50s? Yeah, this was the 50s.
Yeah.
So
it's a little bit slower. But,
right, it's not like they were running through the computer, per se. Right. But it eventually came back that someone made the right phone calls, and, oh, yeah, that's a stolen car. He got prosecuted for that. He asked for leniency because he had a baby. The first time he got leniency. And then eventually he got caught doing some more stuff. He was... He went to jail for a little while. That time he went to an actual jail. He was too old to go to the reform schools anymore.
Yeah, and that was, what, like a 10-year sentence?
Well, this is the first one. I think the first one was shorter than 10-year.
The first one. Okay.
He went to jail. He was, I'm mixing up some of the history here, but basically he went to jail for a little while. He learned about prostitution and pimping, and he decided when he got out he wanted to be a pimp. So he got out, and he started trying to run girls and be a pimp.
Right.
That didn't go super well for him, like he had hoped. But that's what he was trying to do, was to be a pimp for a little while. And eventually got in some more trouble, and that's when the whole 10-year sentence thing came in that you're getting to. The reason that's important is... the reason that's so important is that the his wife left him. Mm-hmm. So when he went to prison, first she came and visited him. They had a baby and everything. And then she just stopped coming. They actually thought because of overcrowding and good behavior, he was going to get out of prison really quickly. But that time he didn't get out of prison really quickly because when she stopped coming, his mother came and told him, oh, you know, your wife's leaving you. And then he started acting out and acting crazy and getting in fights and stuff. Other important things that happened there is he kept demanding more and more of his mother. His mother had felt guilty because she really wasn't much of in his life, because she's the one that sent him off to school. She's the one who went off to prison. You know, so he didn't have a good relationship with his mother. But while he was in prison, what I'm trying to get to with the whole prison part is he started learning things. He learned more about cars and stuff. He got a guitar, and he started playing music more and more. Mm-hmm. He very much was into playing music, and people in the prison thought, oh, Charlie's pretty good at this. He also studied this book by Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People. He took a whole class. They taught a class in prison. On this book.
Yeah, I took that class.
Did you? Because you know you look...
I had to take it for the radio job that I had.
Really? Well, you know, you look kind of like Charles Manson. If you hold your eyes just right.
Oh, gee, thanks. Appreciate that.
See? There you go. Do them crazy eyes.
Yep. I know it.
yeah.
Oh.
So, this Dale Carnegie book was super important. This is going to influence the whole rest of the story. So basically, well, since you've taken it, tell us a little bit about it. If you need some help, I got it in my notes over there.
I was going to say, yeah, I see it in your notes. That was, you know, how long ago did we meet? A dozen years? So 11 years ago that I took the course. Right. It's all the specific section of the Dale Carnegie course that I did was really intended for salespeople. Right. It's the kind of things that you have here. You know, don't criticize. Right. Don't criticize somebody. Just work them through the process and get them to the end goal. Right. Listen to people. Learn about them. Figure out where they're from. Right. There was so much emphasis placed on small talk. Right. Which, if you know me, you know, small talk is not really my thing. Right. But they walk you through this whole outline of, just think of it like you're walking up to somebody's front door, right? It's, you know, you're welcoming to them because, you know, or they're welcoming to you. You're asking them questions about where do they call home, not where do they live, but where do they call home, right? Because there's oftentimes a discrepancy there. You know, ask about family, but don't ask specifics about family because you never know what the result is going to be, right? If someone's in a weird predicament, a lot of that, like you say here, get the other person saying yes, right? You want them giving you positive feedback, right? And you're guiding them through a process to where eventually at the end of it, they look at you as their best friend and they only just met you.
Bingo. And the funny thing is, people who took the course with Charlie, they mentioned about how he was super enthused into it, like hyper-focused on this thing, mm-hmm. all about this course, until they got to the end of it. Then he just checked out. Because right. he got the information he wanted. He learned what he needed to learn out of it. He figured out he could use these yep. things to manipulate people. And it seems a pretty benign thing. We've all heard of this book. I would say mm-hmm. 75% of the people who say they've heard of it have never actually read it. Right. But they know some of the concepts and things. It's a part of our popular culture, mm-hmm. even many, many years later. When was this book written? In the 40s, 50s?
Oh, yeah. It's a long time yeah. ago. You know, and it's part of that sales culture, right? So if you've ever had a job or known someone with a job in sales, right, they're taught these things, even if they're not going through the course.
Well, I learned right? my sales stuff from Zig Ziglar. It's
part of sales.
I could tell you a whole thing about Zig Ziglar. I'm a big fan of Zig's.
Right. A lot of his stuff even has roots in this.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, it's similar.
The same kind of idea of get people saying yes, right? Have them on the positive side of things so that when you present them with the final request, it's more likely to be a yes.
Well, and these are concepts that we even use in our jobs. Both of us use them in our jobs. I know your job's changed yep. a little bit recently, but definitely I know that in the job you had before that, you know, you were mm-hmm. supposed to spend some of your time doing this sort of stuff.
Right.
You know, getting to know your clients and things like that, because we don't work in just regular IT environments, right?
Right.
So that's an important thing. I think this is a thing that preachers use, and Charlie became a preacher of a sort. Mm-hmm. So this is one of the things he learned. He also studied Scientology.
Yep.
There were some Scientologists in prison then. It was kind of a more popular in the culture thing then than it is now. What did we know about the yeah. Scientology? Do you know some of the basics of the Scientology there?
Not really. Not that I would want to, you know, speak on right in a public setting, right? There's things that I think that I know, right? But you know me, and I like to have an actual source to back something up if I'm going to say
well,
it in a spot.
Let me go over just a couple of people can hear quick me. Things.
I mean, I could grab Dianetics off my shelf if you want.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I got a little summary of Dianetics basically here. You know, the first part is the mind is divided into two parts, the conscious and the reactive mind, right? Mm-hmm. The reactive mind is what's responsible for all your negative thoughts, experiences, emotions, and that can negatively affect your behavior, your well-being, all that stuff.
Right.
But through the practice of this Dianetic stuff, a person can access and clear their reactive mind, resulting in going to a higher level of spiritual awareness.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, clear all that out. They do that through auditing, right. Using that fancy yep. machine, right?
Right. Yep, and you become clear, right? And then Thetan?
Isn't that operating the right word? Thetan.
Yep.
But yeah, so that's kind of the basics of that. And we may go into that in a later episode if we ever do an episode on Scientology. There's a lot more to Scientology.
Like I said, I've got
that.
Dianetics. I can start reading. It's only like 800 pages long.
Yeah, it's boring.
right.
But it is a whole thing. So he studied the Scientology stuff, and he studied this Dale Carnegie stuff while he was in prison. And here's the thing. Charlie was tired of being picked on. Charlie was tired of being the one who's being beat up, the one who's being taken advantage of. He's pushed around his whole life. Yeah, he'd mm-hmm. done some bad things, but he was a petty criminal. He was just a petty criminal, you know? And
right.
he was tired of that. So that's why he had tried doing the pimping thing. He thought he'd learned and listened to some of the pimps in there about how you basically take control of a woman and make her do things for you to make money. But he wasn't all that good at it. By learning Dale Carnegie's thing, things changed. And again, I'm trying to keep us in our time frame here, mm-hmm. so I'm going to jump ahead a little bit. He goes to get yep. out of prison. So a few things he brought out of prison with him. One was this love for music. He really loved music. He loved the Beatles. especially. Mm-hmm. And he played guitar, and he was really thinking he could go to LA and get him a recording contract and become big time.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, we go over some of these cult leaders, some of the common things I see when I read these books and articles and watch things about them. Very often I find people trying to insult the leader, trying to talk about how bad they are at this and how bad they are at that. And it bothers me a little bit. It's a little bit of a skew, right? Like, okay, yeah, he was a bad guy, but now we're going to talk about his personal hygiene, you know?
Right.
And I see that with Charles Manson too. Charlie, as he was known. I also see people talk about, well, Charlie really wasn't a great musician, you know? When he got out of prison, it was into the 60s. And I've listened to an album that ends up getting released of his eventually. I don't think he was that great of a musician. Now, I'm not probably the best judge of that, but...
I was going to say, there are popular people today that are not the greatest musicians.
This is true, too.
Are good at advertising,
so
marketing.
He gets out. He wants to get a recording contract. He thinks he's going to get a recording contract. But he knows he's got to figure some things out. He don't have a whole lot of job skills. He's worked with the horses at one time. He's got a little mechanical skills, you know. And he made some friends in prison. So he gets out. He's in L.A. His mom has already moved away. She actually has adopted another daughter and cut ties with him. And did not want to deal with him anymore. His wife's gone. He really doesn't have anybody. He had a friend from prison that he goes to stay with. Now, y'all, when you get out of prison, you have to have someplace to parole out to. Almost nobody gets out of prison because they're completely done and this is it. They parole out. And you have to parole out to somewhere. So I'm not sure how all that got worked out. I know that's a very difficult thing if you have no friends and family to go stay with who are also not crackheads or something, right? I don't know how that got worked out, that he got to go stay with somebody he knew in prison, because that would be an uncommon to be allowed.
I don't know. The 60s was a completely different time, man.
This is true, too. So he, in prison, he had made friends with a guy who said he had some contacts in the music business and told him to go see so-and-so, I think it was at Universal, to go play for him about maybe getting a recording contract. But he knew he needed to work on his music some more and get prepared to do that. So he was around L.A. and he bounced around L.A. doing some petty stuff. I think he stole some cars and things, and that just really wasn't working out too well. So a friend of his had invited him up to Berkeley, and he went to his parole officer and got permission to go to Berkeley, of all places.
Okay.
Now, we think of Charles Manson as like a hippie from the 60s and everything. But one thing to know is that Charles Manson was a good 10 years older than most of his followers. He's in his 30s when he gets out of prison. And he goes up to Berkeley, and there's all these college students protesting. Yeah. This is the beginning times of the Vietnam War and the whole hippie movement culture thing, counterculture and all that. And up in Berkeley, and it's a whole different thing. This is not a scene he's seen before.
Right.
He thinks he might make a little money playing guitar on street corner, but there's a lot of people playing guitars on street corners. And he's not one who's... It's said that he wasn't very literate. He obviously could read. He carried a Bible with him and read his Bible. He only read Revelation. Right. He wasn't interested in the rest of the Bible, just Revelation. If I was going to pick one book, I don't know if that would be the book I would pick.
It's pretty popular among cult leaders.
It is popular among cult leaders, so maybe that's a good sign.
Just saying.
Then he met this woman named Mary. She was a librarian up there. Somehow, he talks Mary into letting him move into her apartment, pay no rent, work no job, and just lives off her for a while. He was just very charming and used his skills to do that.
Right.
She'd buy him drugs. He was big into weed and things. And then he would spend all day just going out and visiting with other people and things. And then he realized that the crowd he really wanted to see was in Haight-Ashbury, which is not at Berkeley. It's in San Francisco. Okay. So he would go across there and go to San Francisco and go over to Haight-Ashbury and go hang out. There was much more of the old beatniks turned into hippie scene, not the student protesters. A lot more drugs. LSD at the time was legal and was becoming illegal quickly. A lot of LSD happening, a lot of marijuana. And he realized, he was thinking about going back into pimping, but he realized that there wasn't a future for him in that. But he's seen all these gurus. There were other people who were spiritual gurus. And they would gather followers. So he decided to gather him some followers.
Yep.
If he could do that, he'd get other people to work for him. And so he would just go meet. His specialty was young, vulnerable women. The younger, the better. Often teenagers. Often these were children.
Yeah.
You know, his target age was 14 to 16. And he'd meet these young women. So he met a woman, a teenage girl, really, not a woman, a girl. And he talked her into, oh, yeah, they're together and everything. And they were together sexually, physically, all that stuff. And then he brought her back to Mary's house and told her, I'm bringing her in, too. And Mary just accepted it. Mm-hmm. That was her first step down the path right there.
Yep.
And eventually he brought more and more. He bought an old school bus like hippies do and made it kind of into a camper thing.
So what I hear you saying, right, out of all of these things, Charles Manson was one of the very first influencers.
Right. Well, and that's the thing.
I mean,
he really
wasn't. A lot of these things are the same kinds of things happening today.
And that's the thing, though. He really wasn't the first. He was copying what he's seen other people do.
Right.
Like, he wasn't the first to come up with these things. There were other people doing the same stuff.
True. Yeah. Okay, so maybe not the first, but an early...
Remember, this is when communes were forming and things like that?
Right.
And so there was a lot of social change in America and stuff happening.
Mm-hmm.
And so where are we at in the story? So he's got the school bus.
Sorry.
Yeah. And he's trying to build up his followers. So he keeps meeting these girls and getting them to follow him until he has, five, six, seven, eight girls that are following him. Just the way he would just get them to just completely give up everything. Right. Sometimes they would get somebody and they'd have their parents' credit card or they'd have a little cash. And maybe he didn't want to keep them around permanently. So he'd just keep them around long enough to use up their credit card.
Long enough to get their stuff.
Or they'd have a car, and he'd keep them around until they signed over his pink slip to him. So he could take their car and take their possessions and sell it. Stuff like that. He supplied them with drugs regularly. They had daily LSD
Lots
sessions.
Of drugs.
That was a big part of where money... Those were cheap back then, but that's also a big part of where their money went.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the reason I'm laughing, y'all, is y'all can see the rest of the video. Behind Brian, he has a visitor sneaking up behind him.
Oh. I don't think they can... I don't know if they can... I don't know if they can see her. Oh, there she is. Yeah. That's fun.
But anyways, go ahead.
I was going to say, on the LSD topic, we'll dig into it a little bit more on the theology side, but one of the things that he used to do was he always took less LSD than everybody else. So they were strung out and he was lucid, right? And could influence them and tell them things and manipulate them when they were in that vulnerable state.
Yep. That's why.
I don't know if you were getting to
that. That's why the worship leader wears earplugs.
Okay.
I mean, he gets the hype going. He gets the bass.
Boom, right.
Boom, boom. Gets everything going. That makes a little camera move. And gets everybody just feeling it. The worship leader's got earplugs in the whole time so he maintains control of the environment.
Right.
It's manipulation.
Yep. It is.
The same manipulation's happening that Charlie Manson was doing with administering LSD to his group.
Mm-hmm.
So they travel around a little bit, a little aimlessly. Eventually, they move to Haight-Ashbury, and they spend a little more time recruiting. And a lot of this was happening very fast. This was actually just a few months in between this stuff happening. It was happening very quickly. He still ain't got no job. Most of them don't have jobs. He learned a few important things in Haight-Ashbury. There were these people. Well, I hope I got this name right. I think they were called the Diggers. The Diggers were a group that would go through to the grocery stores and dig through the dumpsters and pull out food. Then they'd take this food and come together and they'd feed people in Haight-Ashbury. See, Haight-Ashbury was known for having very low-priced drugs all over the place. Free love, hippie movement thing. When that came out and started making the news that was there, hundreds and thousands of young people from around the country got on buses and came to Haight-Ashbury. No money, no place to live, literally laying on the streets. It became sad. It was this whole cultural thing and this free concert, and they all cleaned up after themselves, and look how great they are. And then it devolved quickly in a matter of weeks as these thousands of kids came to Haight-Ashbury and just strung out, laying out there. You know, it's Central California, so they weren't that cold, but, you know, in the cold. And so what these Diggers would do is they were kind of a community organization. They would work with different churches and stuff in Haight-Ashbury. They go and dig this food up out of the grocery store dumpsters, and they'd have, you know, free meals. You've seen this parody in like King of the Hill and stuff where the hippies are serving free meals and everybody contributes something and all this. Well, he learned from them how to get food so that they could feed themselves. They didn't really have to work, you know?
Right. Yeah. So we're rapidly approaching our goal time per section, right? Of about 30,
and I haven't even got to the fun part, huh?
And we haven't even got to the fun part. So let's skip ahead to the fun part.
Well, I guess it ain't the fun part, right? Well, let me just say
that's not exactly. They didn't
hate Ashbury.
Thing,
eventually, they moved to L.A. There's a couple important things I got to hit, though. One of the big things is Dennis Wilson. So when they went to L.A., they were living in their bus, kind of traveling around. But there's really too many of them to be living in a bus. There was some houses they could stay in. It was popular in the culture, especially among Hollywood, to, like, hitchhike everywhere. Like, movie stars were hitchhiking. It's crazy. Nowadays, we would never consider such a thing because you get killed. And they did back then, too. But it was common to hitchhike. It was common to pick up people, bring them to your house, let them stay a night or two. So Charlie and his girls would take advantage of that. He would actually, like a pimp, he would share the services of his girls with whoever they were staying with. And that's how he would purchase a place for them to stay, basically. Wow. He would try to make friends. And he told the girls, go make friends in the music industry. Well, somehow one of them met Dennis Wilson, who was a Beach Boy. He was a drummer for the Beach Boys. And they stayed at Dennis Wilson's for weeks and weeks and weeks. That's important to know because he supplied them with a lot of things, and they kind of robbed him, and they stole from him, really. Not so much rob, but stole from him. For instance, they stole some Beach Boys gold records from him. They famously ran up a dairy bill of $800. On his charge accounts, they would borrow his Rolls Royce and go around. Dennis Wilson owned a Rolls Royce and a Porsche, and yet would go hitchhiking for fun places.
Which still one of the ones hitchhiking.
Yes.
Wow.
They ended up moving out to this place called Spawn Ranch, which was an old movie set where a lot of old westerns were shot. And their group grew. They eventually added some guys to the group. And again, part of the reason he could add the guys to the group is he shared the services of his women followers. That was a big deal. He eventually started calling himself Jesus Christ. He told them that he was Christ.
Yep.
Go ahead. What was you thinking?
I was gonna say we'll get to that. That's where things get fun.
Well, he started
most of the time, right? He was
Charlie.
He was that hippie, right? And he wasn't Jesus Christ. He was JC.
Oh yes, yes.
Just gotta make that clear.
JC, right? Are you with me?
Yeah, he.
Yeah. Well, and he changed a lot. Like, he didn't always preach the same stuff. You know, he kind of grew like a lot of cult leaders. He started at one thing and kind of went into others.
Yep.
He demanded devotion very much. They would do this thing called creepy crawly, where he would have his followers go break into people's houses and move stuff around. Not necessarily to even steal, but just move stuff around to freak with them. Freak with the man, right. You know? By bumming a place to live, they would sometimes people would give them cars. Sometimes they'd steal cars. They were not above theft, but that wasn't their major thing. He got into drug dealing for a little while. The Straight Satans was a motorcycle gang. Motorcycle gangs were popular back then after the whole Hell's Angels thing. So he got into bed with the Straight Satans. He was dealing drugs. And he had friends who were part of the family, and then he had his family. The family were closer, and he called themselves the family.
Right. The family. Yep.
And what ended up making them so famous, kind of to jump to the end here, is eventually he told his followers that they were preparing for what he called Helter Skelter. He claimed that the Beatles were foreshadowing the end of the world and that he was going to lead the world after this race war that supposedly was spoken of in Revelation. It isn't, by the way.
Right. Yeah.
Nope. And that, we'll go into that more in the theology, but basically he told them the end was coming and here's why. And we need to start killing people. Originally, they started killing people because they had killed a drug dealer over a bad drug deal. Then to cover up with that, they killed someone else. And then when one of their friends went to prison, they thought, we'll do these copycat killings, so we'll get him out, because they'll know it can't be him, because the same killings are happening. And we'll go ahead and help the Helter Skelter. So the one thing I haven't even mentioned yet is that Charlie was a huge racist. He hated black people.
Absolutely.
Yep. He didn't share that with all of his followers. He shared it with some, but not all. He tried to talk about this Helter Skelter thing, which he said would be a big race war. I've got to say what it is. It would be a big race war, where he said the black people would rise up and kill off most of the white people. In the meantime, Charlie and his followers would hide in a hole in the ground. And then after a while, the black people would realize they could not rule the earth themselves, and they would go to Charlie and ask him to rule.
Yeah. A very specific hole in the ground.
Yes.
Just leaving that dangling for our theology episode.
And, you know, so anyway, so they started these killings. And they famously were very, very brutal in the murders. Charlie did not do the killings himself.
Absolutely.
He had his followers do them. Mm-hmm. He might have done the first one, but he didn't even completely do it by himself. But all the others, he orchestrated, he told them what to do, but he had his followers kill people. And they were thought they were just obeying Charlie. Or they were just obeying Charlie.
Yep.
And
even had his followers attempt to kill some of his followers.
Like, what do you mean?
Like, he had a couple of followers that were starting to disagree with him and go against him. And so he sent one of his more loyal followers to them to kill them. And they were able to escape, and that was it for them. They were no longer part of the family.
I'm not sure I remember which follower that was. I know he killed...
Yeah, it starts with a P, but I don't
know. One of the ranch hands, who wasn't part of the family but knew about their stuff. And he killed one of his followers. Right. They called Zero. Possibly. Somebody killed him. They told the police that they were playing Russian roulette, but the gun had 8 chambers in it. In the revolver, and all 7 bullets. There were 7 bullets and 1 spent round. It really wasn't Russian roulette.
Doesn't sound like Russian roulette.
Yeah, but the police didn't care because another hippie died. They just didn't really care. What made the police care was they killed Sharon Tate.
Sharon Tate.
Who was married to Roman Polanski, who at the time had just made a movie called Rosemary's Baby, probably one of the most evil movies in existence.
It's up there. Yep.
Other people may disagree, but to me, that is one of the most scariest, downright evil movies I've ever seen. It's not on my list to ever watch again.
Nope.
Yep. Anyways.
And that was the Tate-LaBianca murders, the two that, you know, really settled things and got them onto the we have to investigate and get these people in jail category.
Yeah, and the police bumbled that investigation.
They were so brutal. Oh, like, you know, I mean, I know my first round of college was a criminal justice major, but reading Bugliosi's information about the investigation and the fact that the police didn't write down names, they didn't record anything.
This was in the era of Dragnet. So, if they had just done what they did on Dragnet, they would have solved the crime, but they didn't.
Right. Yep.
They had the murder weapon a couple days after the crime, but because the police departments in the same department didn't talk to each other, nobody knew.
Yeah, it was a total mess.
What basically got Charlie and the family caught was they started talking. They couldn't help but brag. Yep. Several of them bragged to people all over the place. And eventually, after enough of that, even though there wasn't social media, had there been Facebook, they would have been caught in 12 hours. There wasn't social media back then, so it took a few months. But eventually, word got back to the right people, and there's something going on here.
And you know, you talked about leniency earlier. While Charles was in jail, he still received a whole lot of leniency.
Oh yes,
he people could come and visit him and spend time with him all they want. I mean, he was running that jail.
And he was still running his family. He had family members in other jails that he was able to run communications back and forth. Not everybody in the family was arrested. Everybody was guilty. And he was still, communicating with people. His music album got made while he was in jail. He finally got an album out while he was in jail. He used his own notoriety for that. The guy who helped him with that, he had been recorded previously. And the person who recorded said he'd done a horrible job. And I've listened to the recordings. It's bad.
Right.
But the guy who, there was a guy, one of his friends, some of his friends, they didn't think, they thought, Charlie's just a hippie. He's a peace-loving guy. He preached about giving up your ego and surrendering your ego and love and loving one another.
Right.
He didn't preach murder to everybody like this. He wasn't known to be very violent. Now, in his group, he would get violent with some of his women, especially Mary, the first one. When he would get frustrated, he would work out his frustrations by beating on her. And he would try to hide that from the rest of the group. Some people knew, some people didn't know. Right. And nobody questioned him. It was, you don't question Charlie.
Yep. So, 1971. What happens?
Well, by 1971, he's in prison.
He is in prison, sentenced, found guilty, sentenced to death. Only to have that sentence commuted later to life in prison.
By our favorite politicians. The liberal Californians.
Yep.
Although...
And then he finds...
You know, I know we're live on Facebook here. And I know I'm supposed to be conservative and pro-death, but, you know, if someone killed someone in my family, I'd be like, yes, string them up, right? But in reality, I'm against the death penalty because so often our government gets it wrong. I don't think they got it wrong in this case, but there have been innocent people our government has killed. And I would rather we keep people in life for prison, even though it costs so much and all this stuff, than we kill an innocent person.
Accidentally killed the wrong
Give
person.
Them every opportunity for every... I mean, how many times have people come up in just recent years, and now that we've got all this DNA, they're able to use DNA evidence and science that we didn't have before to prove they were never even there.
Yep.
So I'm really not pro-death penalty, even from my comment there. But yes, the death penalty laws got changed in California, and so his sentence got changed from death to that. And there were other killers. Again, Charlie might have had something to do with the first killing, might have, you know, actually done the first one, but most of the others, he did not actually do the killing. He just right. ordered the killing. He set it up. He manipulated the crime scenes, things like that. But he didn't actually do the killings. Well, I think that just about wraps it up for our history section.
I think so. I think that is a full-on history of Charles Manson. I don't know if we could have done it any better. Although you did most of the talking for this one, so.
I did do most of the talking, and I am tired. So
I like that. I like it when you do all the talking.
I think I'm going to go ahead and end this stream, and we'll work on our other sections. So on our new YouTube thing, let's talk about that real quick, because people are listening now, and also this is going on YouTube now.
Okay.
So we're still doing the podcast. Y'all are going to hear us on the podcast here.
Mm-hmm.
But we're also putting this stuff up on YouTube now. Right. And we tried tonight just as sharing with our friends, streaming on Facebook a little bit. That's really just for fun. But the YouTube video is going to be edited and placed on. And so people should be able to expect that. We're still going to do where we break it up into sections. So you don't have to listen to 3 hours of us talking about one cult.
Yep.
Okay, well.
Yep. Well, thank you.
Thank y'all for listening, and until next time.
Thank you for joining us here on Faith, Frauds, and Falsehoods. Don't forget that we have our website, faithfraudsfalsehoods.com, where we post a more detailed blog with references so that you can go and take a look at all of this information for yourself. Also, remember to share this with a friend and help us get the word out there for everyone else. We'll see you in the next one.